From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany defended President Trump after pretty widespread criticism of his announcement that even though there is no evidence that the drug hydroxychloroquine either treats or prevents COVID-19, he is taking it to stave off the illness. Here's the president yesterday.
Yeah, I've taken it for about a week and a half now, and I'm still here.
Dr. Stephen Nissen is the chief academic officer of the Miller Family Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. Doctor, is there any evidence that this drug can prevent COVID-19?
There's no evidence yet. There are studies underway, but there's no proof that the drug actually can prevent or treat COVID-19 illness.
Let's be clear, because after the president suggested months ago that it could treat the illness, a man took what he thought was a form of chloroquine, it was not, and he died. And his wife said he took it because the president said to. What are your concerns about the president now saying that he's taking hydroxychloroquine as a preventive?
Well, we are concerned that patients will act on this information. The drug is out there. It's widely available. Some of it was hoarded when this first came up. And it's important for the public to understand that hydroxychloroquine has adverse effects. It can cause heart rhythm disturbances, and those heart rhythm disturbances can actually be lethal.
Well, a recent study with nearly 400 patients with COVID-19 who were being treated at Veterans Administration centers found there were more deaths among the patients who were given hydroxychloroquine than those who didn't take it. Some studies have been stopped because of, as you said, this fatal reaction having to do with heart issues. There are studies ongoing. And there is a study at the University of Minnesota looking at whether hydroxychloroquine can prevent the coronavirus as opposed to treating. And a professor there told USA Today there's no data that this pre-exposure use can prevent COVID-19. They're continuing the study, but right now they see no evidence. So the president, we know, has heart disease and is also has obesity. Do you have concerns there?
Well, look, it's between the president and his physicians whether he takes it. The problem is when you make a public announcement, the public will take that at face value, and they may act on that information. And we don't want people taking hydroxychloroquine, particularly if they have heart disease, but even if they don't. This is a serious drug. It's used primarily in the U.S. to treat rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. And the reason the FDA keeps it on the market is because those are serious disorders where the benefits likely exceed the risks. But the most common reason why drugs are taken off the market is the kind of heart rhythm disturbance that hydroxychloroquine can produce. And so we don't want people taking this without good evidence because it can be a fatal reaction.
Well, and as you mentioned, it also keeps the drug, because people are hoarding it and stockpiling, it keeps it from people who need it. We're going to be speaking in the program to a woman with lupus who can't get the drug because it's being, you know, stockpiled, bought up. And then there are the health concerns. Now, we should say the White House physician said just what you said, that they approved the president taking this because the potential benefits outweighed the risks. We know the president has had contact with people in the White House who have been diagnosed with COVID-19. Your thoughts on that? I mean, it would be speculation.
Well, I don't agree that the benefits are likely to exceed the risks. If everybody that's been exposed to the virus were to take hydroxychloroquine, we would have a huge number of people taking it, and we would see an outbreak of this heart rhythm disturbance that is known to occur with hydroxychloroquine. So I think it's important for the public to just take a deep breath and wait. Let's see what the evidence shows, and if it shows benefit, I will be the first to say, great. But in the absence of scientific evidence of a benefit, this is entirely speculation, and the risks are very well known. Just a couple of weeks ago, when I was in the coronary intensive care unit, a patient with rheumatoid arthritis taking the drug came in and had a series of heart rhythm disturbances that were very nearly lethal, required multiple cardiac shocks, was a very close call. I don't want that to happen to large numbers of Americans who might misunderstand the benefits and start taking these this type of drug.
Dr. Stephen Nissen, Chief Academic Officer of the Miller Family Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at the Cleveland Clinic, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We turn our attention now to the impact of the coronavirus on the 500 tribal nations in the United States. Nearly 4,000 people have tested positive on the Navajo Nation, and more than 140 people have died, which means the Navajo Nation now has the highest per capita infection rate in the country. The number of cases continued to grow as tribal governments waited weeks for delayed relief funds allocated to them through the CARES Act. For the latest, we're joined by Anna V. Smith. She's assistant editor of the Indigenous Affairs Desk at High Country News. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So, Anna, earlier this month, federally recognized tribes began to see some of those emergency funds allocated to them through the CARES Act. But even still, it's only about half of the $8 billion allocated that they were supposed to get over a month ago. Can you take us back a bit to what exactly is behind some of these delays?
Sure, yeah. So to begin with, in early March, the Families First coronavirus relief package set aside $40 million for tribal governments for things like healthcare preparedness, but that got caught up under the Centers for Disease Control not being able to hand over that money to the Indian Health Service. So that preparedness money wasn't able to get to tribes so that they could kind of scale up. Then moving into the end of March was the CARES Act that was signed into law. And the National Congress for American Indians had asked for $20 billion originally, but they instead got the $8 billion that you just mentioned. So going into April, we saw some litigation from tribes over those funds because they still hadn't been distributed, and the fact that the U.S. Treasury was trying to include Alaska Native corporations into those funds, which tribal governments were concerned about that because, you know, you have a finite amount of money, and that would have added 230 corporations, so it would have significantly reduced the amount that tribes could get. As of May 5th, the Treasury has finally started to begin to distribute some of those funds.
So many delays, and these delays have real human consequences. In New Mexico, we're hearing that Native Americans make up about 50% of the total deaths in the state. Now that some tribes are finally getting some of their federal relief package money, what are the resources that are needed most, and how is this money getting spent?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, there are limits to what tribes can spend with the CARES Act funds. So things like public health expenses, medical expenses incurred from coronavirus, or different economic supports due to shutdowns. So there's like a specific set of things that they can use it for. It's not like a blank check. And for the Navajo Nation, for example, they received $600 million of those funds and are now working on an expenditure plan. So they're still not seeing that money, you know, going to work in these communities yet because now it has to go through their process. But President Jonathan Nez has said he would like to see the money spent on things like personal protective equipment, water infrastructure, food packages, and things like that. And it varies from tribe to tribe. So the Crow tribe in Montana received $25 million, and they're spending it similarly. And then the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe in Nevada is taking a different tack and are distributing some of their funds directly to tribal members, kind of like what the federal government did with stimulus checks.
Can you give me a sense? You know, we have been focused so much about PPE for folks, food for folks who have now lost their jobs. I mean, these are all efforts that are happening in real time. Are there any other efforts that have been happening on many of these tribal lands to help people while they wait for this money?
Yeah, there's a lot of food package programs that's going on. People are still trying to deliver water on the Navajo Nation. Roughly, I think 40% of Navajo households don't have running water. And so those kinds of efforts that are kind of grassroots level have been really important as well.
Yeah. In so many ways, COVID-19 has really made clear the complex relationship between tribal governments and the U.S. federal and state governments, not just with the allocation of these funds, but now in South Dakota, for instance, the governor's office says it will sue two tribes if they don't take down their COVID-19 prevention checkpoints on state and federal highways. In terms of questions of sovereignty and legal jurisdiction, What can we expect next?
So you're definitely right that the big picture is really about tribal sovereignty and also the right for tribes to govern themselves and keep their tribal citizens safe. So I think that it's kind of yet to be seen what exactly will happen. The tribes have said that they will consider her proposal to make changes to the checkpoints, but they haven't decided one way or another yet publicly anyways about that. So I think it's still very much up in the air about what will happen and if it'll be settled in good faith.
That's Anna V. Smith. She's assistant editor of the Indigenous Affairs Desk at High Country News. Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So what is true about air conditioning and the coronavirus? Remember the recent study of a woman in China who dined at a restaurant days before she had symptoms of COVID-19? Researchers say she infected four at her table and five people at other tables because an air conditioner right behind her spread droplets from speech from her to all of them. And what about the president's claim that some sort of light, maybe a UV light, can get inside the body and destroy the virus? Well, scientists were quick to say once the virus is replicating inside the body, nothing can stop it. And people who make UV lights were quick to say, no, putting UV light on your skin can cause cancer and cataracts. Nonetheless, lights sold out. But might there be some real benefit if UV light is used not on the skin? Donald Milton is a professor of environmental health at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. He joins us on Skype. And Don, start with the AC study. What did that tell you about how the novel coronavirus can spread?
It suggests that the virus is present in droplets that can hang in the air and be blown around by an air conditioning system. The droplets don't have to be extremely small if there's enough air movement to keep them hanging in the air. And, you know, your nose can pull in pretty large particles. Think about pollen. We get pollen in our nose all the time this time of year.
And by the way, one pleasure of speaking to people who are working from home is that I get to hear their birds in their backyard.
I forgot to close the window.
Please don't close the window because, first of all, fresh air, which we want to talk about, and we love hearing the birds. But staying with unfresh air, which it turns out that this AC system in use in that restaurant in China might have been, and it's something that's being increasingly used in the U.S. It's an air conditioner that recirculates the inside air with no filtration or fresh external air intake. How do you view that in light of the coronavirus pandemic?
Those systems are really common. You know, often even in hotel rooms, you have just a recirculating fan coil unit. These newer ones, sometimes called splits, that sit up on the wall or on the ceiling, are very efficient from an energy point of view and have become very popular for that reason. But they don't bring any dilution air in from outside. And in that particular restaurant, they had exhaust fans, but they apparently had them sealed up at the time. So there was no fresh air coming in. And, you know, what we're seeing is that outbreaks where you have a bunch of people infected all at once like that are almost exclusively occurring indoors in poorly ventilated environments.
Yeah. So what do we take from this? I mean, how vigilant should people be? Should they check what kind of AC system there is in a restaurant or in their office?
Well, I think for the restaurants and offices, it's going to be the building managers and the owners that need to check into what is going on in their space. And, you know, if you have enough dilution ventilation coming in from outdoors or some way of cleaning the air indoors so that you can achieve 5 to 10 liters per second per person. Sorry to get technical there, but we're beginning to hone in on the numbers of the amount of air that you need to be bringing in. And the bad outbreaks seem to be occurring in places that have very little air coming in.
I bet there are building managers listening who are taking notes. You recommend that windows be open. We remember in the great flu pandemic of 1918, there were things called fresh air hospitals. They literally put a lot of the patients in no-walled, open-sided tents because it, you know, it was thought that fresh air was a disinfectant. So just to be clear, can fresh air kill the coronavirus?
Well, no, it's diluting the virus, not killing it, but reducing your exposure to a level where you're not likely to get infected. Sunlight, there is new data coming out on sunlight, and sunlight is a disinfectant.
Well, what do you mean by that? Because once you're sick, once the virus is inside you, you're certainly not saying sunlight can kill it then.
No, not at all. But if you are with other people outdoors, you have infinite amounts of dilution ventilation, and if it's daytime and the sun is out, the sunlight is killing the virus that's in the air or on surfaces, so that you have multiple modes of preventing transmission.
Ah. And I just want to be careful there as well, because you're not saying, hey, go to the beach because, you know, you can jump all around and hug each other and everything because the sun is going to kill whatever viruses might be coming out of your mouth in conversation, and you're fine. I don't think you're saying that either.
No, if you're at the beach or you're in the park, you still need to maintain social distance because the virus concentration in the air close to where it's coming from is going to be a lot higher than it is 6 feet away. That's one of the big things about the 6 feet distance, is that it helps with all the modes of transmission, touching things that are contaminated, getting hit by big droplets, or breathing contaminated micro droplets.
Yeah. So it's good to hear that there can be some mitigation from sunlight, from fresh air, but you still have to be careful and keep up with some of the social distancing restrictions. But let's talk about ultraviolet light. We know there are three kinds. The UVA light that, you know, comes from the sun can wrinkle and damage your skin. UVB light can cause skin cancer. UVC gets filtered out by the ozone layer, but researchers have found it's effective against viruses, bacteria. But we're hearing that this new coronavirus needs an incredible high dose that, from my layman's reading, would fry people. I mean, I'm reading in a report from Columbia, UV light is a highly efficient antimicrobial modality effective against bacteria and viruses. However, generally not practical in scenarios where people are present because UV can cause cataracts and cancer. So with that caution, what is your thinking about how UV light can be used?
The UV light can be used in three ways. One is to decontaminate surfaces that are can be exposed to the light when nobody's there. So, you know, you can go into a room and set up a thing and then remotely turn it on, but you better be out of there when it goes on, because it's going to cause sunburns and particularly damage your eyes if it's in the UVC range. The UVC doesn't penetrate the skin very well, so it's not a big cancer risk, but it is a big risk to causing a very bad eye irritation. The other two uses, people sometimes put it in the air ducts of air conditioning systems. Mostly there it's been used to try to control bacteria and fungal growth on the cooling coils, but it can be used to clean the air. And then the third use is one that goes way back to the 1940s, demonstrating that upper room UV, it was being used in elementary school classrooms in Philadelphia during a measles outbreak, showed that it could really help stop a measles outbreak in a school.
Back up a second. Upper room UV, what do you mean?
So these are fixtures that are designed so that the light doesn't get down to where the people are. So you have to have a reasonably high ceiling. And the area above people's heads, the air is being treated and virus is being killed in that part of the room continuously. So a very large volume of air. And if you combine that with something like a ceiling fan to make sure that you are pulling air up from around the room's occupants and through the kill zone before it comes back down for people to breathe, you can get very high equivalent air changes compared to pulling in air through a window or from an air conditioning system.
And again, it takes away that concern about the UV light hitting directly on someone's face or their eyes.
Yes, but it requires careful design and installation and maintenance. It's not something for the faint of heart.
Right. again, building managers hopefully are listening, and someone's not hoping to do this in their back bedroom. But UV in air systems, as you indicated, it's not unheard of. We've heard of hot yoga studios using them, anecdotally some senior centers and offices installing them, hopefully in the way you've described, because the BBC quotes this UV light maker who says he sold out of lights to people who want to disinfect people with them. You know, somebody who wants to install it at the entrance to a supermarket, you pass through this UV light that would somehow disinfect you. This is not what you're talking about, UV light on skin.
No, it's not. Not at all.
Yeah. And when you said ceiling fan, do you support ceiling fans in general, or is it just as a part of the system?
You know, it's a part of this system. It's in general, it's just moving air around, and it would be no different than that restaurant in Guangzhou where the air conditioner was circulating the air around. It would just spread it. It wouldn't do anything to limit it.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating, but as with many aspects of COVID-19 and the coronavirus, it sounds like in the wrong hands, it doesn't work very well. You know, like people who were drinking disinfectant. It sounds like UV has a lot of promise, but in the right hands.
Yes, it requires some care in and know-how. So it has the potential to be highly effective and would be, you know, very useful in appropriate places. Brigham and Women's waiting room has had upper room UV for many years.
This is the hospital in Boston.
In Boston.
Yeah. Donald Milton, professor of environmental health at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Don, thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, Robin. A pleasure.
And we mentioned people looking for fresh air during the 1918 flu pandemic, but a children's rhyme that came from that time reminds us people also worried about airborne viruses, just like we are now.
And as startups like Uber and Airbnb lay off workers, tech's biggest companies are taking advantage of the economic downturn in what our next guest calls a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to expand their power, crush rivals, and change their political fortunes. Elizabeth Dwoskin is a Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. And Elizabeth, you write, tech giants are profiting and getting more powerful even as the global economy tanks. What are they doing to consolidate their market power?
Well, it's more like what is their position versus the rest of America? I mean, look at JCPenney and other retailers are laying off hundreds of thousands of people and going bankrupt while Amazon stock is trading at an all-time high right now or close to its all-time high. And when this shakes out, I think you're going to see a much greater consolidation of power. And you can see it in the fact that all of the tech giants are continuing to hire. Facebook, as the prime example, has announced that they're hiring 10,000 people this year. What company can broadcast that they're hiring 10,000 people? And they're almost looking to Silicon Valley and saying, hey, people in startups, people maybe at the Airbnbs of the world or at smaller startups, come and work for us because we are the ones with the money. And you have a generation of young people that are going to want that kind of security, I think, if they can get into those jobs.
But you also spoke with a venture capitalist who said he's looking for, quote, a new class of winners to emerge after this. Where is he looking?
I think it's, you know, important to remember that there are still a lot of people who have investors that have money and can still take meetings and can still invest, even at the point where we're going to see this wave of startup bankruptcies and layoffs that, you know, it's already happening. You think about the last recession, 2008, and it's actually been studied that it's a pattern in almost every recession where companies turn more to automation. They replace workers with automated services, software and robots, and there's more outsourcing. One of the ones that I think I mentioned in the story was like a robot garbage picking company. That company apparently is getting a lot of calls. You know, maybe it's both cheaper for sanitation companies that are cash strapped right now, as so many businesses are during the pandemic, and maybe even safer for the workers. I mean, that's one of the arguments.
I have one last question for you really quickly. You know, before this pandemic hit, most of these companies were facing these investigations from attorneys general and in some cases the congressional committees. Those have not gone away, but of course they're on hold. Do you think the pandemic will change public perception of these tech giants that we're talking about at all?
That's like one of the most interesting questions to me right now, because you have these efforts, especially like by Apple and Google, to kind of make themselves into essential services. Like Amazon grocery delivery, you could argue it's already an essential service. You look and you say, okay, well, that's definitely a way to endear yourself to government. We saw news this week that antitrust investigations against Google are going forward, are moving forward. But you also know that practically a lot of these investigations are slowing down. Anyone who's a corporate lawyer is dealing with the other side, the opposing counsel, saying, I can't get documents right now. They're on servers somewhere else. I can't pull them. I can't download them. And that's happening with the investigations of the tech companies, too. They're saying, you know, we can't comply with these requests in these investigations.
Hmm. That's Elizabeth Dwoskin. She is a Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Elizabeth, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya. Good to talk with you.
This year's college graduates face a grim future as they enter the worst job market since the Great Depression. And if history tells us anything about entering the workforce during these periods of high unemployment, it's that the class of 2020 will most likely earn less and experience an unstable financial future for years to come. It's particularly difficult for those entering the restaurant industry, which has already lost about 8 million workers so far in this pandemic. That leaves culinary grads like Trevor Dembski thinking hard about his future. Trevor is a graduate at the Columbus Culinary Institute in Columbus, Ohio, and he joins us now. Trevor, welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, congratulations. First of all, I know you officially finished classes back in February, and you've had to fulfill a certain amount of work hours to become a certified culinarian. How are you feeling about things right now? The restaurant industry has taken a major hit.
I know it's going to be rough for my industry for the next few months, maybe even for the rest of the year, especially for other young culinarians like myself to try to find work throughout the future. New safety and sanitation procedures that will be coming along throughout the pipelines the next few months. Trying to win the trust of the public back just to come back and eat, or just overall to win back the hospitality business for everyone like in the United States, let alone the rest of the world, because of the times we're in right now, unfortunately.
Yeah. What got you into this industry?
I think it would mostly be because of my upbringing. My mother was a functional cook, and my father was just sort of there to do like basic French toast or this, that, and the other, or hamburger helper meals.
I love how you say functional cook.
Like, I know. It was like, hey, let's put chicken in a crock pot with cream of mushroom soup, and then you guys find whatever vegetables you want to do. And I'm like, all right, that sounds like a meal. But it wasn't until I went to a technical school where I came from, which is Pioneer Career Technology Center. When I went there my sophomore year, I saw that all of these like juniors and seniors are learning how to cook. They're learning how to operate in a restaurant. And I'm like, this is something I can get behind. I really enjoy this over doing graphic design or childcare or anything like that. There's something that spoke to me about food, especially with how my parents would cook at home. I'd say, I could maybe do this better. What could I do differently? Mm-hmm. It wasn't until my senior year I said, you know what? I think I'm actually going to do something with this instead of just saying, oh, you know what? I went to technical school. I got a degree. I'm going to work in an office now.
Yeah. Your mom, as you mentioned, the functional cook, I feel her. I totally understand what you're saying there. I might be just like her. But she is an elementary school art teacher. And your dad is a special effects artist and like millions of Americans right now out of work. How difficult has that been for you and your family?
I would say the first thing that sort of hit us all was it was a moral defeat. And it's not even just my family alone. I think, it just, like you said, it affected millions of Americans itself. for example, my mother had never not had a job in her entire life. So when they said you have to be laid off at this specific amount of time, it just was sort of devastating for her. And she really didn't know how to function for a certain amount of time. My dad, which again, special effects artist, he loves to go out and network. He likes to go out and do art. And one of the most important trade shows for horror and special effects, I believe, was held in Tennessee. Since the coronavirus hit, he wasn't able to attend. And he was sitting on stock with like thousands of dollars worth of product that he couldn't sell anymore. And then my brother, he's a senior in high school. He's now in the weird spot of like, I got to experience a proper high school graduation. I got to see prom. And I told my brother, I'm like, you're not going to get a normal thing just like me. And he said, well, that's pretty much how the cards were dealt for my life. But that doesn't mean that he can't do something to make it up in the future.
Is that how you're thinking about your future?
I think that's pretty much how we should all think about it, our future, especially these last few months. I pretty much have spent my entire time locked inside while my boyfriend usually has to go out to work because he's considered an essential worker as a warehouse employee. I usually am looking at my bookshelf like I am right now and saying, okay, so what have I not read? What can I do a little more research on? What can I cook tonight for dinner? What can I maybe educate myself a little better on and push myself and make myself more valuable so that when everything opens back up, I can say, I've learned all this while I was locked away. I want to be a little more important to your team as much as I want to be important to myself.
That's Trevor Dembski. He's a graduate of the Columbus Culinary Institute in Columbus, Ohio. Oh, Trevor, I see such a bright future ahead and just this wonderful attitude that you have at this time of uncertainty. Again, all the best and thank you, Trevor.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
Well, the school year is winding down, such as it was or wasn't. The pandemic forcing millions of students and teachers to move their classes online. And one course that's proven tricky to teach remotely is science. Kate McGee from member station WBEZ in Chicago took a look at how teachers are making it work.
Back in March, Marcy Gutierrez and her first and second graders planted lima beans and grass seed for a unit about the life cycle of plants when Chicago Public Schools said they were shifting school online to prevent the spread of the novel coronavirus. She wondered how to continue when they wouldn't be together to watch the seeds grow. Then she thought of a solution for her students at John Hay Academy.
Why don't I send it home with them so they could do that at home?
She prepared little packages of dirt and seeds for the students to grow and post photos on their class website. Alex is one of those students. We chatted on Zoom recently, where he showed me what's happening with his grass seed.
This is the big one.
Oh, wow.
And this is the short one.
Alex and his mom, Cynthia Gonzalez, have been doing a lot of science and art projects at home since social distancing went into effect. Alex says he misses his friends and teacher. The only way he can connect with them is through his classroom website.
I saw some of my friends. It was Jordan Kennedy.
Once I post one video, then seven others come right away, you know, in the next half hour. So I think that they're liking that engagement. They could see how their classmates are doing.
That's his teacher, Marcy Gutierrez, again. Across Chicago and the country, science teachers are getting creative as they take an extremely hands-on subject and teach it from a distance. And experts encourage science teachers to look at the students' environment at and near home as the new science classroom. Maria Varelas teaches science education at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
There's also lots of stuff that can be done in nature and in the world, right? Without any kind of sophisticated equipment, especially for younger children.
Just noticing birds or insects on a walk around the neighborhood can help students learn about their behaviors, and you don't need a device or internet to walk around the block. For older students, it can be tougher. Equipment is more expensive, and the topics are much more complex. Loyola University Chicago professor Carissa Hipscher teaches environmental chemistry. She says she was also lucky enough to send students home with supplies, piles of dirt and equipment for labs, which are now conducted on Zoom, like this one.
This wasn't an activity I had originally planned for us to do today, but obviously things had to change a little bit.
First, Hipscher plays a video demonstration of the lab.
So you should have your sand pebbles and large pebbles.
Then she splits students into small groups to complete the experiments. Students tune in from across the country, including Hannah Sather in Seattle and her lab partner, Tori Windham, who is in Wisconsin. They're measuring how porous different types of soil are when you add water.
Okay, yeah. We just pour it until it reaches the bottom.
Okay, cool.
The next lab requires students to gather a soil sample from their homes. They'll now have a wide variety of samples from across the country, which Hipshire is choosing to see as a silver lining during all this chaos.
We weren't going to get that kind of opportunity before. So kind of making something kind of cool out of it.
At the University of Illinois at Chicago, a human evolution class did a virtual scavenger hunt at the Field Museum of Natural History, where you can take tours of the museum on its website. One biochemistry class is studying reactions of carbohydrates at home using carbs students find in their kitchens. As the shutdown continues, or if online courses continue to be the norm in the fall for some schools, teachers need to think about new projects. Back at John Hay Academy, Marcy Gutierrez drove flower kits to her students' homes for the next unit on plant life. She was hoping students without internet could share what they grew once students returned to school. But now that won't be until the fall in Chicago. It's unclear if she'll even have the same students or what they'll be studying when they can reunite. For Here and Now, Kate McGee in Chicago.
What is clear? Teachers rule. Let's check in now on the cruise ship industry, which has been crippled by the coronavirus. There are still 100,000 crew members trapped on ships, many held out at sea for at least 2 months. Some of the crew members are sick. There have been at least two apparent suicides. Bruno Quels is a 30-year-old music director from Argentina working on the Celebrity Infinity ship owned by Royal Caribbean, hoping to get a flight home to Argentina from Barbados in another 9 days. But he's been told that before.
Every time repatriation flights end up not happening, on some occasions without the notice of its cancellation or the reasons, that is particularly concerning because it damages our hope. And losing that is the most dangerous thing that can happen in this context.
That sounds ominous. Bruno was speaking with our next guest, Taylor Dalvin, a business reporter who covers tourism for the Miami Herald. Taylor, welcome back. And boy, this story that you tell, Bruno, part of a couple, Julia Whitcomb, a singer from Illinois, the other half, they met during rehearsals in Florida, spent 57 days trapped on board. Now, first, this was supposed to be a 14-day quarantine after someone tested positive on the ship. What did they tell you?
They, you know, crew members who are in this situation are just growing more and more desperate to get off by the day. And Julia was actually able to get off on May 9th, but Bruno remains stuck. He's actually been switched to a different ship a couple times and is now, you know, hopeful still that he can get a flight home.
How did Julia manage to get off and get back to Illinois and he can't get to Argentina?
Julia is a U.S. citizen, and she was able to get off finally in early May after a standoff between her company, Royal Caribbean, and the CDC. The CDC wanted executives, cruise company executives, to sign a legal agreement holding them criminally liable for following the CDC's health protocols, which say that crew getting off these ships can only be transported home via private transportation. Mm-hmm. The companies have to provide the crew masks. There are other rules and guidelines that they have to follow. And so that created a standoff for several weeks where the companies weren't willing to sign that agreement. And finally, they were for her.
Yeah. Well, and so there he is stuck along with thousands of others. Then there's the industry itself. What's going to happen with the cruise industry? Our tourists want to get back on these ships. How about crew members? How about labor?
Some crew members I talked to say they won't be coming back after being, you know, held on board for several months and having to go through this experience. There are definitely passengers that are eager to cruise again and are booking cruises for later this year into next year and the following years. Carnival Cruise Line, the largest cruise company, has announced that they'll be starting cruises on 8 of their ships on August 1st. They haven't announced yet any new protocols for how they'll protect passengers and crew, but those tickets are for sale and people are buying them.
And will they have to follow any kind of regulations when they're at sea, things like social distancing? Who do they answer to?
As far as protocols go, any ships that come and go from U.S. ports will have to follow rules, CDC rules. As far as when they're, you know, out at sea in international waters or traveling across the ocean, that's when the International Maritime Organization takes over.
It sounds like you're saying that at least some of these lines feel they're going to survive this. Are those contemplating not making it through this?
Right now, I mean, they've all had mass layoffs, furloughs. They're really cutting expenses and trying to stay afloat here with a zero revenue scenario. I mean, there's no cruises happening. No one's buying anything on any of these ships. About a third of cruise company revenue comes from onboard purchases. Mm. So it looks like they can all make it through at least 2020 without any cruises. We'll just have to see if that August date holds or if cruising resumes later this year.
And back to Bruno, floating around, you know, trying to get home to Argentina. We remember this has been going on since the beginning of the pandemic when President Trump said he didn't want cruise ships to dock on the West Coast because that would affect the numbers of people diagnosed with COVID-19 in the United States, and he didn't want the numbers to go up. And now we have people from other countries and crew members. You know, do they feel like they're somehow being ostracized or, you know, somehow penalized because they got stuck in the middle of this pandemic?
Definitely. And we see countries being extra cautious when it comes to this. I mean, we know that cruise ships are exceptionally dangerous for COVID-19 spread, but they do feel like it's being held against them. A lot of times their own countries aren't allowing them to come home, or requiring things that, you know, these cruise companies say are too expensive or aren't agreeing to, like private transportation and other things. So it's both the countries having these strict rules and trying to protect people who are in their countries, and then also these companies dealing with the logistics and the price of those logistics.
Yeah. Well, please stay in touch with Bruno for us and let us know what happens. Taylor Dolvin, business reporter covering tourism, and she's really landed hard on the cruise industry for the Miami Herald. We'll link you to her reporting at herenow.org. Taylor, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.